The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't see...
We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books Podcast. Chris Knight is an anthropology professor, the recipient of the Evolutionary Linguistics Association's Lifetime Achievement Award, and the author of the book Decoding Chomsky, which was published by Yale University Press in September of 2016. According to Chomsky, he's a confused person and his book was utter nonsense. I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast, but this week's episode is being edited by Al Musso. Thanks, Al. If you haven't signed up for the membership podcast for Zero Books, that's Inside Zero Books, you should do so. The more patrons we get, the more digital content we'll produce, and the more voices you'll get to hear. Right now, you're listening to whatever music Al decided was best for this introduction. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Chris Knight and I discuss Decoding Chomsky.
I'm Chris Knight, and I've written a book on Chomsky. It's called Decoding Chomsky, Science and Revolutionary Politics. It came out in 2016, and just this month, the paperback has come out. And since I published the hardback, there's been quite a bit of controversy. And possibly the most interesting thing is that Noam Chomsky has responded in public saying, Chris Knight's whole story is a wreck, a complete nonsense throughout. and I was expecting him to be quite cantankerous, because obviously he often is on these issues whenever there's any dispute with him of any kind. But what I wasn't expecting was for him to say that it's complete nonsense because no military research was conducted at MIT. So perhaps I should explain. What I've argued in the book is that for Chomsky, he really had to move mountains at MIT, which is the number one military research university probably in the whole world. He had to move mountains to avoid colluding with the military. It was not easy. And my argument is that we can best explain the actually rather unusual kind of linguistics he's been doing, and also the very different political activism, by realizing that he was in a contradiction. He was in a difficult spot, and he had to resolve it. It was difficult to be working for the military, which in a sense he was. He was working in a highly specialized electronics lab funded by the Pentagon. And officially he was working on machine translation to be used by the military for purposes of command and control of missiles and other weapons. That's what his official remit was. But of course, Chomsky had a conscience, unlike so many of these people. And so it was quite complicated for him to be working for the military and at the same time hold his head high, and as he puts it himself, be able to look himself in the mirror each morning without too much shame. The way he did it was to make absolutely sure that while he was working for the military, he would make it absolutely clear his hostility to what the U.S. military industrial complex and the U.S. government, particularly as the war in Vietnam was intensifying, what they were doing. So in a sense, if you're working for the military and also against the military, you really don't have much choice. You have to divide yourself in two. And as a result of that, we have two versions of Noam Chomsky. And I have to say, Noam himself has often said that. He's often said that he lives a kind of schizophrenic existence, doing those very, very different jobs. One the paid job at MIT, and one the unpaid, obviously, anti-militarist activism. And in fact, when he was asked by an interviewer not so long ago, Noam, what do the two Noam Chomskys say to each other when they meet? His answer was immediate. He says there's no connection. Basically saying they don't talk to each other. And I guess it's changed very strange, but my own view is that it's in a way interesting and even positive. I mean, out of intense contradiction often come marvelously interesting and creative consequences and results. And I actually see this extraordinarily intense passion of Chomsky's hostility to the military, not as somehow inconsistent with the fact that he was working for them, but as actually a result. If you're working for these people he thought of as criminals, of course, more than other people, he's going to have to make clear his hostility to what they're up to. So the two things kind of connect, but in a kind of paradoxical and contradictory way. So anyway, what I'm saying is that I knew that Chomsky wouldn't kind of go along with the book, because obviously it's in many ways quite critical. But what I didn't expect him to do was to say that no military research was being conducted on the campus of MIT, especially since he himself had said that right on that campus, research was being conducted into missile guidance systems, so command and control systems for guiding nuclear missiles and so on. I mean, it seemed to me astonishing that he should take that line of attack against me, but that's what he's done.
That is interesting. I can say this. When I talked to you before, I didn't necessarily find the arguments about his role in the military to be the most compelling aspect of your book, although it was compelling. For me, it was the way, just the fact, whatever the reason, that he had separated his philosophical and scientific pursuits from his activism that was the most significant fact, and that was a fact that you couldn't deny. And then you could try to explain it, and you could explain it the way you're doing now by pointing to his real lived role in relationship to the military-industrial complex. You could also explain it through his ideological commitments, and by that I don't mean political commitments, but his philosophical commitments as part of, say, the analytic tradition, and where the analytic tradition ended up in terms of the relationship between thought and the world. And that's the one that was more compelling to me. That's the one I've been thinking about lately. But I just want to stick with this kind of everyday factual claim that you're making that he's denying. I mean, how ridiculous is it for him to deny that any military research has gone on at MIT?
Well, the other thing that's happened since I published the book is that quite a number of Chomsky's students from those early years, Barbara Party, Arnold Zwicky, Haj Ross, have been in correspondence with me. And in fact, they've made the point far more powerfully than I was able to make the point myself. So what actually was happening was that in 1958, because MIT was so heavily burdened with kind of in some ways responsibility for the entire continental defense of the United States against Soviet missile attack. It was a massive, massive involvement. In order to make things manageable, MIT, jointly with the U.S. Air Force in 1958, set up an actual research and development arm called the MITRE Corporation, about 20 miles away from MIT in Bedford, Massachusetts. And the crucial point is this, that MITRE was the place where the actual command and control systems were being operationalized, or at least turned into mechanics, turned into engineering applications. And I hadn't realized this before, but Barbara Party and the others have told me that they were working in the MITRE Corporation specifically to work on English as an input language for the control systems. And what Barbara told me was that the rationale for that was that in the event of a nuclear war, the generals would be in their bunker and try to manage things, and it would be far easier to teach the computers to learn English than to teach those generals to learn computer language.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were directly using Chomsky's transformational grammar in the version applicable to English to make all that possible. But more than that, Dan was actually a consultant to the MITRE Corporation. And what illustrates the paradoxes and contradictions, perhaps most of all, is the way Chomsky was there and wasn't there. So I'm told that he did enter the MITRE Corporation's building in order to supervise the students, but he refused to get a military pass. And Arnold Zwicky tells me that as a result of that, because Noam didn't have a pass, he had to be followed around the whole time. And so when Noam went to the toilet, Arnold had to accompany him all the way up to the toilet, all the way back again. And this just captures exactly the conflict and contradiction I'm focusing on in my book. Chomsky was present in this military-industrial complex, in these laboratories, and yet had to be not present. So he is present in body, absent in mind, having to somehow deal with the contradictions and conflicts. And there's absolutely no doubt that the idea that there was no military research at MIT, which is now claimed, I just don't even know why they're even attempting that line of argument. It's so, so absurd. I mean, I can understand he might say that he himself never produced anything of military use. And actually, that would be true. And that's true because none of his theories actually worked. I mean, I really want to emphasize that. Nothing actually worked.
Right.
And he can put a positive gloss on that. I mean, in fact, Barbara Clarke kind of does. She makes a kind of joke of it all. She says we were able to convince the Air Force that learning generative grammar was an absolute national priority of the U.S. National Defense. And we were managed to persuade these people from the Pentagon that all kinds of interesting, abstract, abstruse questions about grammar, you know, deserve funding by the military. And in a way, she said, we thought of this as almost a benign pacifist subversion of the military. We were getting the money, and it was preferable to be getting the money for useful research into the nature of human language than for that money to be spent on bombs and weapons to be used against the Vietnamese. So that's one whole argument. You can actually argue, and some people I know have argued in response to my book, that Chomsky was playing an absolutely devilish clever game, wrenching money from the Pentagon, and yet, in a way, as we say in English, selling them apart. I mean, not producing anything usable. But I can't quite make that argument work. I just cannot believe that Chomsky was so much celebrated and promoted, given the name professorship by people like Jerome Wiesner, on the basis that he would produce nothing that ever worked. My view is that the whole idea of finding a sort of underlying digital code to all the world's languages was megalomaniac nonsense from the start to finish. And the military, you know, had that idea that somebody might be able to crack the code of all the world's languages, in which case they'd be governing the whole planet quite easily, because with that code, you could shout it at any missile in any language or whatever, and the missile would understand what you were telling it to do. But there's no doubt in my mind that idea was nonsense, but also there's no doubt in my mind that the military, firstly, they believed that it might be possible, and secondly, Noam and others went along with that. In my view, they were fairly convinced that they might make it work. And when it turned out not to work, that was when Noam sort of moved on to different versions of his linguistics, and we could talk about the new versions.
Yeah.
That's interesting to your listeners.
Yeah, it is. So let me just read his statement, because I looked it up. And it's funny to me where I found it, by the way, because I found it at the North Star, where you have published a response to it. And one of the readers at Zero Books, a man named C. Derek Varn, was formerly the editor of the North Star. And and Mark Fisher's infamous, or famous now, Exiting the Vampire Castle essay was published at the North Star years ago. Now here you are publishing at the North Star about your book and the response to it. So it's funny to me how we all run in the same circles. But you write, okay, so Chomsky writes that Knight makes an assumption common to those who are unfamiliar with government science, technology, policy, and know nothing about institutions like MIT. At the time, MIT was almost entirely funded by the military, including the music department. The modern advanced economy was created substantially by government funding in one way or another, often by Pentagon funding of research universities. There was zero military work on campus. You can find the facts from the Pound Commission report on the topic in 1969. Nor did the military involve themselves in any way in what was going on. That, of course, included my work. Or, for example, the work of colleagues studying American Indian languages, translating works, the work of Wilhelm von Humboldt, etc. Knight is also deeply confused about the work on linguistics that I and others are doing. I explained it to him in response to an email request from him, but he plainly doesn't understand. Thus, he opens with a profound confusion about universal grammar, the technical term used for the genetic component of the human language faculty. He thinks this has something to do with some kind of universal language that he believes the military were interested in. There was no interest of the sort, and if there had been, it would have been nothing at all to do with our studies of universal grammar. It goes on like that. The whole story is a wreck.
Yes.
Right. Should I read the final paragraph that he writes here? In fact, the Pentagon has...
I'm very familiar with the whole statement.
Today, no one else is.
Maybe your listeners need to hear it again, yes.
Yeah, in fact, the Pentagon had so little concern with what we and others were doing that they paid no attention to the fact that our lab also happened to be one of the major academic centers of resistance to the Vietnam War from the early 60s, or the fact that I was brought to trial for these activities. In brief, complete nonsense throughout. That last paragraph is sort of a giveaway to me. But anyway, so what is he saying here? That he's denying that he ever went to the corporation that you mentioned that was off campus?
No, he's not specifically denying that, because until I found it out, I don't think anyone really knew that he was actually a consultant to the MITRE Corporation, which was the place where the abstract linguistic theories where the Air Force was attempting to turn them into actual machines, actual computers, which would be programmed to assist command and control of the missile system. So nobody, as far as I know, nobody really knew that except the students such as Barbara Party and Arnold Twitchy, who just recently got back to me. So Chomsky wasn't denying that, but he's making a wider claim. I mean, as you say, you just quoted him saying there was no military research on campus. And then his authority for that is the Pounds Commission. Well, the fact of the matter is the reason why the Pounds Commission was even organized to investigate the question by the management was precisely because there was a huge student uprising against military research on campus in 1968 and particularly in 1969. And to invoke the Pounds Commission is really strange because Chomsky himself was sitting on the Pounds Commission, and what the Pounds Commission in fact did, it managed a kind of PR job. It managed to draw kind of a line through the campus, including it as within the campus, the halls of residence, the restaurants, and some of the teaching rooms, and then artificially excluding, by definition, from the campus, the labs in which military research was being conducted. So they were able to claim on the result of this this fraudulent PR job that no military research has been conducted on campus. What Chomsky argued was that he claimed that he wanted such military research as was being conducted to be conducted out in the open. And he was actually against this fraudulent claim that the military labs were not on campus because they simply redefined the boundaries of what it meant to be on campus. So how on earth no one can invoke that PR job as support for the idea that military research was not being conducted on the campus, I really fail to understand. It seemed to me very strange, especially if that is his only authority for the claim.
So, just to be clear, in the past, in 1969, perhaps,
yeah,
Chomsky was against the Pound Commission.
He was a member of the Pounds Commission, but he was in a minority.
Okay.
He had a minority line. So, I mean, if you like, the right wing was saying, who cares about military research on campus? Let's keep it there. The sort of soggy left was saying, let's do a bit of a PR job and let's kind of pretend that the military research isn't on campus by the MIT management divesting itself of direct responsibility for the military labs and drawing a dotted line around the campus and succeeding by a PR smokescreen, and Chomsky was against the smokescreen. He was saying if there is military research being done on campus, and he agreed clearly there was, it shouldn't be hidden. It should be out in the open so that students can continue protesting against it. Now that position would have made no sense had there not been anything to protest against. I mean, Chomsky was arguing for students to continue protesting against the military research being done on campus. He was absolutely clear that it was being done on campus. And now he's suddenly using that same Pounds Commission to say that it wasn't being conducted on campus. It's disappointing. I mean, it really is disappointing.
So I'm on your Science and Revolution blog now, and there's a quote here from him saying, there was extensive weapons research on the MIT campus.
Yeah.
In fact, a good deal of the nuclear missile guidance technology was developed right on the MIT campus and in the laboratories run by the university. This is Noam Chomsky himself in his 2004 book, Language and Politics.
Well, thank you, Doug. So, I mean, what I'm saying is I'm just citing Noam. I mean, he's absolutely clear at that time, and for many, many decades, it's only when he comes across my book that he turns around, you know, 180 degrees and denies what he's been saying all his life. I mean, why would he think that's going to be persuasive? That's, to me, it's a sign of the strength of my book, that he's forced to rely on that complete, I'm afraid, nonsense by way of defense. And I don't even know why he's doing it, because it's almost as if he thinks I'm accusing him of collusion with the military. And I'm not. I'm saying he had to move mountains to avoid collusion with the military. And the way he did that was to make sure, certainly after 1965, that his linguistics was so extraordinarily otherworldly, so abstract, so unrealistic, that it couldn't be used for any practical purposes, let alone killing people in Vietnam.
You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
And so I'm actually exonerating him from the guilt. And totally recognizing, by the way, that he was a genuinely passionate opponent of the military onslaught against the people of Vietnam. And a very effective one. And of course, I'm also arguing that one of the reasons why he was so authoritative in denouncing these war criminals was that he was actually rubbing shoulders with them at MIT. He was Jerome Wiesner, the number one military scientist in the United States, the one who invented the missile gap, was his immediate superior. And in fact, it was Wiesner who gave Chomsky his job and gave him his first interview. So Chomsky knows about these people, knows what they're up to, knows that they're in effect criminals. He makes that point perfectly clear, because he was rubbing shoulders with them. And in a really important sense, he was part of that military-industrial elite. So coming from, you or I can criticize the military, and it's kind of cheap, it's easy. But it's actually more authoritative and more powerful and moving when it comes from inside the military-industrial establishment. Chomsky knows what he's talking about, because he knows these people intimately.
But I mean, look, I'm sorry, but the most important thing to me about this exchange is that he's lying. I mean, I can't think of it any other way. That he's lying in a way that anyone who bothered to check would find out about. He must be relying on his own authority as a major figure on the left to protect him from people being upset at him lying about this.
Well, lying is a very strong, word, and I haven't actually said that. I can understand why you come to that conclusion.
Well, I come to that conclusion because he himself has said, for instance, there wasn't any classified work on campus, but it was 2 inches off campus. The labs right next door were doing classified work, and people were between them all the time.
So when he says there was no work on campus, he's remembering that it was defined as 2 inches off campus. And I mean, you could say that he's not lying, because he's technically correct. It was 2 inches off campus, but only after the Crowns Commission, came to the conclusion that it had to be placed 2 inches off campus. Don't forget, in order to kind of calm the student radicals down. Look, it's off campus, even if only 2 inches off campus. But you see, what I found most extraordinary and kind of impressive about Noam is the fact that each version of Noam Chomsky, each side of his brain, if you like, the military scientists on the one hand and the anti-militarist activists on the other, they're not on speaking terms. And so I think each brain is actually quite genuinely speaking the truth in its own terms. I think Chomsky fully, genuinely believes what he's saying. I don't think he knows or thinks that he's lying, even though the other side of him kind of is saying the opposite of what that voice is speaking.
Oh, man. No, really? I mean, that's even worse to me than him just being a liar.
Oh, dear.
claiming he has a split personality or something. I mean,
No, I'm not doing psychology. I'm not saying a split personality. I don't want to guess as to what's going on psychologically. But what I'm saying is he was in a fix. He's been in a fix all his life. I mean, how can he not be in a bit of a fix if you're working for the military and needing to look yourself in the mirror without too much shame and therefore becoming a passionate opponent of the military and all its crimes? I mean, you have to be kind of two people, and it's not a psychological thing. I don't at all think it stems from any childhood trauma or whatever. I'm not interested in all that. So I wouldn't dream of saying that. I'm saying that all of us find ourselves in difficult situations, and all of us have to cope with contradictions and complexities. And actually, all of us are probably, most of us are doing work, if we're working for money, which is somewhat immoral. If you're working for a bank or a corporation, you're probably not really having very much.
I'm not judging him. I don't think anyone should judge him for working at MIT and for finding himself caught up in the military-industrial complex. I mean, I don't think that that invalidates any of his work.
And
I know that some might say that, but I wouldn't say that. I'm with you there. And I do think that your approach here is a fair one, as far as like saying, look, it actually gives him a little more power and he's more persuasive for having been that close to the very thing he's protesting against. I think that's true as well. But it's disappointing to me. What's really disappointing to me is that, look, it's a very familiar approach to dealing with his critics. This, he doesn't know what he's talking about. It's just nonsense. This dismissal, this kind of failure to engage in good faith with a critic.
No, he will never engage in debates, least of all in linguistics. Everyone knows that in linguistics he legislates. I mean, he is linguistics. He is the number one linguist. He's the inventor of modern theoretical linguistics. He doesn't really need to engage in debate with, you know, lesser mortals. He simply legislates what the facts are. And every now and again, every 4 or 5 years, as I explain in my book, he legislates that everything he's been saying up to now is wrong. There's no such thing as government abiding or empty category principle or deep structure or whatever. And the whole landscape's completely changed. And he simply legislates the new theoretical landscape. And any of his followers who still believe in his former theories is just, as you say, just completely, you know, just dismissed, slapped down, and totally ignored. And if someone has that amount of power, when they legislate, the truth is kind of created. I mean, you legislate the truth. You legislate what isn't part of language. It's a bit like it's a sort of papal authority when you're kind of infallible, because nothing can be untrue, because you decide what the truth is. And what is very unusual is that this is allowed in science. I mean, in science, usually everything's collective. You put forward a hypothesis, people try it out, they test it, they try to falsify it. And what emerges as a result of the collective accountability, which the scientific community invariably insists on, is you know, more or less, at least temporarily, is the consensus of science. But within theoretical linguistics, it's never been like that. As everyone really knows, Steve Pink has pointed it out, and many others have pointed out, that in linguistics, one person kind of wakes up in the morning with an entirely new theory and legislates the truth of that theory. And what's happening here in this question about whether military research was or wasn't conducted on the MIT campus is he's sort of spilled over and using that legislative approach to simply legislate that no military research was conducted on campus. And maybe he now believes that. I mean, I can see why it would be possibly easier to believe that. Lying is kind of intentional deception. And I kind of think that his deception is not intentional, or at least put it another way. This is something which Rob Trivers talks about very powerfully, very persuasively, that if you're going to be a successful liar, the best thing is to deceive yourself. And if you deceive yourself, there's a sense in which kind of you're not lying. You really believe what you're saying.
Let's talk about the part that I can believe he believes, you know, which is that you're confused about the work on linguistics that he's doing, and that there's no connection between a universal grammar and a universal language. In other words, what he was studying could never be used, for instance, by someone who wanted to create a language recognition program.
Okay, well, all I can say is that Warren Weaver was the inventor of the whole project of machine translation. And Warren Weaver had the view that maybe beneath all the world's languages, given that they were digital and in some sense, and that was Jacobson's achievement to prove that language is itself a digital system, that maybe they're like, you know, maybe all the world's languages have at their root, the common root, an underlying computer code, an underlying digital code. And so Warren Weaver suggested that the best way maybe to translate a bit of text from Russian into English, instead of going directly from the Russian to the English, why not translate the Russian into the underlying universal code And then up again from that underlying code into English or whatever other language you want to come out at the end of it all. So this was an idea of machine translation, which would be perfect because the digital code was, you know, once you found it, would be able to accurately represent all the content of the input from Russian or, you know, or any other language. And so that was the project. And okay, now the point is that Lem was working on that project. Until he got his job, he was interviewed by Jerome Wiesler, who is this number one military scientist in the whole United States, part of the administration. You know, he was interviewed by him to work on Warren Weaver's project. And it was Warren Weaver's project, the idea that you could find an underlying, if you like, universal grammar or an underlying common code of all the world's languages, which Chomsky would directly pay to be working on. Now, it's true that Chomsky says when he got the job, when he was being interviewed, actually, he said to Warren Weaver, "I'm not interested in machine translation," by which, of course, that meant he wasn't interested in all the technicalities of the electronics and the gadgets and the software engineering side of things. But he was certainly going to do his best to work on language to provide the theoretical understanding of all human languages necessary for this project to work. So instead of working on the actual machines, if you like, the hardware or the software, Chomsky offered to work on the underlying problem. Is there, beneath all the world's languages, an underlying universal grammar? And his assumption was that such a thing could be discerned, could be found, could be specified. And there was huge excitement. And the excitement came from the Air Force and the other various other military people who just thought, well, you know, if we discover this underlying code, we're made, because we don't even have to learn computer language. We just talk to our missiles in any language we like, in the vernacular, swear at them, say, go this way, go that way, hit them Viet Cong, not that way, you are, so can they hit the other log over there, in any language, and the machines will understand. That was an insane dream, a completely insane dream. Chomsky was employed to work on that. Okay, he was employed to work on it. In the end, it turned out he was unable to specify any of the details of this so-called universal grammar. If you ask him now, and I've got the details in my book, you say, no, all right, at the end of the day, what exactly is universal grammar? But do you know what his answer is? It's anyone's guess. Your guess is as good as mine. It's whatever it is in there that enables a child to learn the grammar of a language. So the answer at the end of the day is he doesn't know. And that's because this universal grammar is a nonsense from the beginning. That particular messianic project invented by Warren Weaver was nonsense from the start. And of course now we do have Google Translate and things, but they work on an entirely different basis. They work through having vast amounts of memory and work on the basis of probabilities. As soon as you put two words together, the system just runs through all the millions of possibilities for what the next word or the next word or the next word might be.
Right.
And as a result of that, you know, that's how Google Translate works. And it's getting damn good, but on a totally different basis. There is no underlying digital code to all the world's languages.
Right. Okay. Now, let me just see if I can push back on this a little bit. But I don't think that your depiction of this is necessarily wrong, my understanding of Chomsky's project was to develop, like, his primary justification, say, for thinking there is such a thing as a universal grammar, is that he believes that human beings are born with a language faculty.
Yeah.
And whether they're born in the United States or in Japan or in Germany or in Nigeria, wherever they're born, they have this faculty. And that faculty must work in a particular way to generate language in the human subject.
Yeah.
Certain conditions have to exist for that to happen, but that the language, it uses external cues, but it's really something that grows out of the human being, just like, you know, your fingernails do.
Can I just stop you there and just say, all of us agree. I mean, I don't know anybody who believes in Pavlov or Skinner, who believes that humans are a blank slate and that children learn languages the way rats learn how to get out of the maze that they've been set in by the laboratory experimenters. All of us know that humans are different from chimps. We're different genetically. We have different structure of the brain. and that a child, on being exposed to language, will rapidly acquire the grammar of that language, and a chimpanzee has terrible, terrible problems, you know, with even the most simple combinations of words, which it can sort of, you know, sign language can be sort of drummed into a chimpanzee at great difficulty, but it never grasps the grammar. So, I mean, nobody disagrees with that, but the point is that language faculty is not grammar. It consists of a whole number of different things: the ability to see yourself as others see you, the capacities for embedding thoughts within other thoughts, all kinds of things. Really, very interesting problems. But to imagine that's the same thing as a universal grammar, which can be specified and has some resemblance to an underlying digital code. Even Chomsky has given up on that. If you say, well, what is this universal grammar, this actual grammar, do you see what I'm saying? That grammar is not the same thing as a genetic capacity to acquire a grammar.
Right, yeah. So, but he's saying that universal grammar is just a technical term. Yeah. It doesn't mean what it seems
that's
to
mean. Right. I mean,
it's not actually about grammar. It's about this genetic thing.
That's how Noam sort of evades all the criticism. He says, oh, it's just a technical term. But then he says, you know, if you say, well, what about language? Is language for talking to each other? I mean, so, for example, he says the first language ever to have been spoken was the result of one individual wandering into a cosmic ray shower and a mutation producing this language organ. But what he then says is that single individual began talking to itself. So you then say to them, but I thought language is, you know, the thing which all of us use when we're trying to share our ideas with other people. And the reason we have words and nouns and verbs and adjectives and words and rules and so on, and the reason we make sounds with our mouths when we speak is because we want other people to share what we're thinking. And if we don't need to do that, we're just thinking to ourselves, what on earth do we need language for? So anyway, his answer to that is to say, well, your definition of language is different from mine. I define language, Chomsky defines language, as internal computation. Fine, I suppose you can do that, but it just means he's not, when he talks about the origin of language or any other question to do with language, it's like ships passing in the night. He's talking about one thing, and all the rest of us are talking about something completely different. And I need to add to that, the reason why for him language is computation is precisely because the military were interested in computation. The military were not interested in missiles talking to each other, having a chat, gossiping, or computers having a chat and gossiping.
Right.
The military were just interested in computation. And of course, in those days, the computers were massive mainframe, you know, standalone computers. They weren't even connected up with each other. And so Chomsky's idea that language is just a single computer talking to itself is a reflection of that particular epoch in the history of the development of digital computers. And it's okay. He can say that universal grammar means what he says it is. Like Humpty Dumpty just says words mean whatever I decide they mean. But it just removes his version of linguistics from what the rest of us consider to be language. And there's one more catastrophic fragmentation of human knowledge when there's this complete chasm between one whole discipline and pretty much everybody else. Because if you talk to pretty much everybody else apart from the Chomsky school, they think language is like talking, it's used, you know, you don't have to have language to think. You can just think. Other animals think, by the way. It is a pretty catastrophic result intellectually. I'm arguing.
Well, I want to. Okay, yeah. So I one more go around on this, and then I want to talk to you about your book. You know, as it's kind of a political project.
Yeah.
So the other reason, other than the fact that the military was only interested in computation because they wanted to have very good control over their missiles and an ability to direct missiles with the English language, say. Another reason that you would be interested in the internal computation of the mind and language as the way that the mind does internal computation is because you're interested in the philosophical question, which is, what is the human self? What is the structure of reality at a certain point? Because if you're kind of a Kantian and you have done this Kantian turn where what's at the center of the question of what is real is really what are the innate structures of human cognition, then you're interested in discovering whether or not language is a computational structure within the human subject in order to understand this kind of deep, long-standing philosophical problem, you know, in the history of philosophy.
Mm.
What do you think of that?
Well, yes, very, very, very true. Let me just say, when Chomsky began his work at MIT, and even before he got his job at MIT, he was speaking to essentially computer specialists. There was a huge excitement at the prospect of the development of the digital computer. And you have to understand why it was that these, what I might call, or you might call, geeks or nerds, you know, basically computer mechanics, why they were so excited by what Chomsky was saying.
Right.
I mean, to be honest, these people were dealing with software. They were dealing with electronics and software. They're dealing with, you know, modules or machines. And that was all. They weren't philosophers. They didn't have a huge, you know, place in working out the meaning of life. But why Chomsky was so popular with them is because he said, look, you might think you're just dealing with digital computers, but do you know what? Inside the brain of every human child is a digital computer. And so insofar as you can work out how these things work, you are now becoming philosophers. You have something to say about what it means to be human. Because to understand computers is to understand the human mind, because inside the human mind is the central thing, is the thing which makes us special as human, unlike chimpanzees and other families, is, guess what? A digital computer. Now, can you see from their point of view, this kind of had to be true. It kind of had to be true because it gave them enormous prestige and status, which they didn't have before. And they were no longer just computer engineers. They were now grand philosophers. But I don't have to say that, you know, I mean, the mind is not a digital computer. The last thing the human mind is, probably, is a digital computer. Digital computers are extraordinarily stupid things. They're completely unable to put anything they receive into any kind of context. They don't have emotions, they don't have agendas, they don't have priorities. I mean, you know, and all kinds of ways. The mind works in parallel. I could go on and on and say that while brain neurophysiologists, not a single one these days thinks the human mind is anything remotely resembling a digital computer. But that theory was around. You know, that theory was around in the late 40s and early 50s.
I'm very disappointed because that means that when I die, I can't upload my mind to the internet and just keep going.
Well, precisely. That was a dream. And of course, these geeks, it was a kind of religion. It was a new way of separating body from mind, a kind of super Cartesianism. Mind is as independent of body as software is independent of hardware. And the software doesn't give a damn about the hardware. You can just carry on replicating that software in any old machine you like. And you can even store it somewhere, and you can be dead for 10,000 years, and then you can suddenly project the whole human being back into reality because you've kept all the information, and information is all that counts. I mean, all that is religious science fiction effing nonsense. It really is total and utter nonsense, and very dangerous and reactionary nonsense, I have to say.
Okay, so now here's what I want to say to all of that is that I agree with you. We can't upload our minds into the computers, I am sad about it. But
fair enough. Yeah, death is a sad fact. I mean, it is very sad.
Yeah, but the other thing I want to say is that I'm not entirely sure to what extent Chomsky. I mean, you'd have to. You know, pull quotes like you can with whether MIT was doing military research, whether or not Chomsky ever thought that the universal grammar or the way that the mind operates to do computations was in any way digital or could be captured in a digital structure.
Well, I'm sorry, Doug. I mean, he calls the underlying principle of language, which he calls it digital infinity. So there you are. I mean, he makes a lot. So that's his name for it.
All right. All right. So now, what is the political aim of this book? I mean, what would be the best consequence of this book coming out?
Well, the best consequence would be a new political movement which puts science, autonomous science, genuinely accountable science, genuinely pluralist environmental science, archaeological science, astronomy, puts that first over and above any kind of ideology. And when it comes to politics, says, right, the only politics we need in these difficult times, these actually terrifying times with global warming accelerating, the only kind of politics that makes the slightest bit of sense is politics which emanates directly from the findings of genuine climate science and other science. So you can't do climate science. You can't work out the extent to which unplanned, chaotic, capitalism is actually ruining the possibility of life on Earth for future generations. You can't just find that out and discover this stuff and then say, okay, I've made my findings. I mean, the discoveries now being made about the rapid pace of global warming, they themselves are discoveries which have immediate implications in terms of the absolute necessity for immediate action across borders, by the way, independent of nation states, just to make the planet, this planet of ours, which is the only living planet we've got, to make sure that we look after it and preserve it for future generations. So my idea, definitely, is to connect science with politics, but putting science first. And unfortunately, what happened with this cognitive revolution, of which Noam Chomsky was, of course, the standard bearer, was to isolate science in a completely incomprehensible kind of ghetto. I mean, it's siphoned off away. I mean, science is now perceived by most activists as somehow incomprehensible, gobbledygook, fragmented, elitist, reactionary in all kinds of ways. And it's really difficult, even for climate scientists, to break out of that and signal to the rest of humanity, hang on a bit, quick, move, all of you, because, it's as if a huge asteroid is heading straight for planet Earth. It's difficult because the result of the cognitive revolution, in my view, I don't say it wasn't a conspiracy, but it was super convenient to make sure that the findings of science were confined as a kind of preserve for the elite and rendered incomprehensible to ordinary people. Now that meant a disconnect between the finest part of human life. I mean, I would say the most precious accomplishment of humanity is actually science. So science is the most rational, collectivist, accountable form of knowledge there is, immeasurably superior in every moral respect, never mind other respects, to religion and nationalism and other forms of ideology. Science is brilliant, but at the moment there's a huge problem about science is the degree to which it's kind of objectified in ways which are not realistic, and the degree to which it's fragmented and rendered meaningless to ordinary people. So and then when I say that, my inspiration is Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. I mean, to me, Engels in particular wanted science to be autonomous and wanted a politics which was based on science. It's absolutely opposite of what people normally think about so-called Marxism, the kind of rubbish that was perpetrated in the Soviet Union, where instead of science being free to determine what political action needed to be taken, of course, you had these wretched political ideologues. And like, Stalin and with the Lysenko affair, actually interfering in science and derailing science and in much the way that Donald Trump wants to derail science and ignore science and twist it to his own purposes. So for me, the ideal is, let me put it more clearly. The ideal is a revolution, a worldwide revolution based on science. That's why I write my book.
Okay. Well, yeah, I was going to say that reminding me of the kind of Marxist project, and one of the reasons that Chomsky isn't a Marxist, I think, is because he doesn't believe that the kind of rigorous, I'm not even going to say scientific, but reasonable or reasoned investigations that we can do in the sciences can apply to the human realm.
That's right. That's exactly it. He's rendered science something disconnected from the things which matter most to us. So you've got science over there, and it looks at objective facts. And even if it looks at what makes us human, namely language, we're just looking at a little box of tricks in the head. And according to Chomsky, there's no such thing as social science, which to me is simply saying we can't be as rational towards social change and social reform as we are when we do physics and chemistry. And I can't see... I mean, of course, I can see why the huge difficulties. I can see all the obstacles to being rational. I can see all the you know, all the vested interests which obstruct being rational. But if we're not rational in our politics, why would it be any use to anyone? I mean, and of course, if you cut off science from activism, you're decapitating the activism. As I put in my book, if you cut away scientific knowledge and information and empowerment from activism, it's like your activism is going to be mindless. And at the same time, what's going to happen to the science? It's going to be tongue-tied. It's going to be inarticulate. It's going to be unable to connect up with social action in the world. And this is the primary result of that post-war so-called cognitive revolution, which in my view was a counter-revolution. It's the total disjunct between mind and body, between theory and practice. And so the disjunct in Chomsky between mind and body, theory and practice, working for the military and working against the military, and because of the power of the cognitive revolution, not really because of Chomsky, there were huge institutional and social forces at work to engineer this disjunct, but because of the power of that cognitive revolution, we have this situation where science is on the one hand, cut off from activism on the other. Tongue-tied science, all kinds of climate scientists. When you hear these climate scientists try to speak, they haven't a clue. They don't know how on earth to convey their findings to ordinary people. They go into funny little bits of detail without rendering themselves completely incomprehensible to ordinary people. So the scientists have become tongue-tied, and the activists have become, in many ways, mindless. Not, I don't mean all activists are mindless, of course I don't mean that, but I mean, if activism isn't based on science, what the hell is it based on? It must be based on nonsense.
Well, it's based on, if you're Chomsky, it's based on an intuitive sense of morality, which you can then reason comes from a human faculty of that gives us our moral sentiment, which we are developing, but that understanding it isn't unnecessary or even necessarily possible in order to develop our moral faculties. We can develop our moral faculties without understanding how those moral faculties actually exist in reality, scientifically or ontologically.
Well, I like the idea that humans have a moral faculty, in fact, some kind of sense of fairness, and even egalitarianism is actually part of human nature. We evolved as egalitarian hunter-gatherers. We evolved to be able to see ourselves as others see us as part of our nature. I like all those ideas. What I don't like is the assertion that all of that can be separated out away from science. To me, science has always been, right from the very beginning, and by the way, I think hunter-gatherers are perfectly scientific, insofar as hunter-gatherers, like other people, when they see something, they check out whether it's a hallucination or whether it's not. And the idea that you check out with other people, do you see what I see? Is what I'm seeing in the world, is that endorsed by what you see in the world? That's the fundamental scientific attitude. And to me, that is rationality. And that's, by the way, also morality. To check out that your perspective isn't simply egocentrism, to check out that your perspective is shared by others. So it's not that I disagree with Chomsky on that particular point, but what I disagree with is the disconnect, is the fragmentation, and the sense of helplessness, utter helplessness, which so many of us feel as a result of that fragmentation disconnect.
Okay, on science, and I think we're almost getting to the end of this conversation. And by the way, I'm sorry that we haven't had it earlier because I always enjoy talking to you, and it's such an interesting conversation. Here's the thing. Science, as we conceive of it in America, revolves around almost a positivist understanding of what's real. So if you can't falsify a claim, the claim is just nonsense, for instance. If it can't be empirically tested, then it's of no value. And there are problems with that position, philosophical problems. It leads to some self-contradictions. For instance, just the claim itself that if it can't be falsified, it isn't real, it isn't a form of knowledge, is itself unfalsifiable. So that's when I hear that, say, Marxism is a science, I want to say, it's a science, but not in the way that we conceive of science now. Science used to be broader in Marx's day, and certainly in the early days of science, the difference between philosophy and science was not so stark. So what do you make of that quasi-objection?
Well, first of all, I just pick you up on one thing there. You said if Marxism is a science, it's a different kind of science. But I never liked the idea that Marxism is a science. That seems to me a license to print money. When Marxists think, because I'm a Marxist, I'm some kind of scientist. I don't think Marx himself or Engels thought in those terms that there was a thing called Marxism and that it's scientific. To me, both Marx and Engels were trying to be scientists. They were inspired by the achievements of scientists in other spheres, primarily, of course, in the natural sciences, but particularly inspired, by the way, by Darwin. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to apply the methods of science to the study of society. But wanted science to be sufficiently free of institutional and class and sectional pressures to be true to itself. And Engels' argument about the working class was that only among the working class were you free of privilege and power and sexual interests. You were only in that context, outside society, on the margins of established society, were you free to be autonomous as a scientist of society. So that's the first point. But to me, it's absolutely clear that if say, you have a theory, a scientific theory, or if you have a theory, for example, about what it means to be human, and more to the point, how it is that we became human, how it is that the human species evolved, how we acquired language, how we acquired a sense of morality and began to apply moral rules in our society, if you have a theory, that theory surely has to be testable. You have to find ways of deriving predictions from your theory and seeing whether you can falsify that theory in the light of relevant archaeological, genetic, ethnographic, and other evidence. Of course, I'm saying all this because I'm an anthropologist and this is what I do.
Right, right.
But I really cannot understand the logic of saying that somehow you can be scientific without worrying about testing or evidence. I mean, that seems to me to be really pretty absurd. And yet the irony is, of course, that although, I mean, Chomsky obviously doesn't in any way consider himself a Marxist, although he often has nice things to say politically about Karl Marx. But Chomsky argues that you've said, that you don't need evidence for your theories. I mean, he says that the simplest theory is the best one. I mean, I'm now talking about, for example, this theory of the origin of language, this theory that a single mutation in one step building on no precursor, install this language faculty in one leap. Well, you know, if you say to them, well, can we please test this theory? He says, well, it's so obvious, we don't need to test it. And well, to most of us, it's slightly obvious. It's an extraordinary bizarre theory. So I'm just coming back to my basic point, which is that I believe, when I talk about science, I mean what everyone else means by science. I mean the kind of knowledge which is collectivist and accountable, and where any theory you come up with, others can try to knock it down on the basis of evidence. And how on earth are you going to get a match between theory and the real world if you don't pursue that course? So now we're talking about a social movement for revolutionary change. How do we test that? Well, I think what Karl Marx would have said, well, the only possible test is that it works. I mean, so far, of course, it's absolutely clear it has not worked. We have not had our revolution. We've been defeated again and again and again and again, and so it doesn't work. And so for me, the only real proof of the kind of theory I'm putting forward would be that somehow, against all the odds, in some maybe slightly miraculous way, because it would seem a bit miraculous, we managed to get out of this terrible mess we're in as a population across the world and reclaim planet Earth, get rid of all these stupid national boundaries, re-establish some egalitarian social order, and look after the only planet we've got for our grandchildren. And if that worked, that would be the proof.
Okay, one last thing, and then I have another question, and then we're done. So, okay, here's an example of something that I think is true that I don't say is scientific, because I have this, I agree with you, the scientific theory needs to be falsifiable, but that I think is useful and profound even. And it's, now, other people may not agree with this truth, but this is one that comes from philosophy. It's just Descartes' notion that if you come, the ultimate fact that you can embrace is that I think, therefore I am. That there is a human subject that is a thinking subject, and that can be known immediately, regardless of whatever particular experiences one is having an experience, that is unfalsifiable. If it's, if true, I mean, you can test it for its internal logic. You can see if there are faults in its coherency. But it isn't something you can go into the world and test, and you can't set up an experiment to see if it can be validated. But I do believe that I think, therefore I am. It's true. I think that's a knockdown argument. So what would you make of that?
Well, what I make is that if you wanted to have a theory which is completely meaningless and totally apolitical and utterly, carrying individualism to the utmost extreme, on the basis that maybe if you're sufficiently apolitical and individualist, you won't get into trouble, you'd probably come up with some such theory. And my view is that Descartes actually did that. I mean, in my view, the whole point was that he needed to avoid getting into too much trouble with the various bishops and people that, causing some problems for Galileo. And as a result, retreated into this kind of circular nonsense. I mean, I think therefore I am is a tautology, because you begin with the word I, and if I, the very fact that I start that whole sentence means that somehow there's an I. And of course it is interesting that Noam follows in many ways down that same trajectory. I mean, there's no modern philosopher who carries genetic determinism on the one hand and individualism on the other to such extraordinary extremes as Noam Chomsky. I mean, the genetic determinism is so extreme, so weird, actually, that he actually claims that words, lexical concepts, even like book, house, and even bureaucrat, and even a silly Putnam was surprised to find out, even carburetor, these are innate concepts in the individual mind put there as our species has emerged, and having hung around in everyone's heads for tens of thousands of years, even before anyone had invented a book, or a bureaucrat, or a carburetor. I mean, that is an extraordinary idea. But, of course, it's one way of removing what's in the mind from anything social. It's just like there is an eternal thing as a result of certain genes. And then, of course, the other thing we mentioned earlier, which is the idea that language is a bit like Descartes, I think, therefore I am. I mean, if I talk, therefore I am, or I am, therefore I talk. It's just like the first individual to speak was talking to itself. So you have this extreme individualism and extreme genetic determinism. What's it all about? And to me, it's absolutely clear. Noam Chomsky, in that scientific sphere, had to be non-political. He had to decontaminate his linguistics and his philosophy, all vestiges of politics. And to do that, he had to decontaminate language and mind of all vestiges of the social. Because as soon as you got anything social in the mind, it's going to be political. Why did he need to do that? Because had it been political, it would have been a very unpleasant form of politics. It would have been the politics of the CIA and the military. So he had to remove politics from his scientific theory. And the result was this absolute, total Cartesian nonsense of no use to anyone.
Well, listen, what do you think could possibly happen around this book and Chomsky that would move it forward, that would get past? I mean, what I'm really asking is, how do we get someone like Chomsky to debate? How do we get someone like Chomsky, who has so much authority within the realm of academia and also in the realm of political activism, although, I mean, he's old, he's going to die soon, so, I mean, maybe that's probably part of how you get there.
He's saying, well, I may well die before he does.
That's true.
12 years older than me, so...
I could die before him, too, but, I mean, he is in his late 80s now, so it's not like he's going to last another 50 years.
That's a lovely question, Doug, and I would just emphasize your question. I mean, it is true that both editions of my book have been completely banned by every single left-wing publisher I can think of. I mean, Pluto Press, Zed Press, Verso Press. I mean, I've had so many letters back from these people saying, Chris, fascinating stuff, a wonderful book, really exciting, really interesting. You've made so many connections and nobody's made before. Can't possibly publish it because it would upset no one. And there is a real feeling that somehow on this one issue, debate is impermissible. It's like the left is quite happy to debate all kinds of things, but not this particular topic. And Noam Chomsky is the only, I don't know, he's the only major figure or scientist I know of who feels he has to say stuff from time to time. I am not God. I mean, do you need to remind yourself that you're not God or remind your supporters that I don't have to...
Only when I'm on LSD do I ever need to remind myself that I'm not God.
And the thing is, I mean, I just say, here at UCL, just a few days ago, we had the book launch for my paperback, and it was fantastic because the students had organized an occupation in support of the lecturers who were on strike, a massive strike across the country against all their pensions being stolen. And so we had an occupation, and the occupiers invited me to move my book launch to the room in which they were organizing their occupation. And we had a wonderful, exciting evening, and every single person there just completely got the point I was trying to make. And so, I mean, what's needed is some genuine action. We need an Occupy movement. We need strike action. We need picket lines. Under those circumstances, people get their confidence back, and they don't have to rely on gods. And the unfortunate thing is, when the left is weak, it needs God. And if you haven't got God, at least you got Noam Chomsky. And anyone who slightly tarnishes the image of God or Noam Chomsky, you know, is somehow disappointing, and everyone just clams up, and they'd rather keep God intact. It is actually disappointing and sad, but it's entirely in keeping with Marxist theory. I mean, you know, revolutionary consciousness isn't something in the head. To get revolutionary consciousness, people have to feel confident and strong. Action is primary. Practice is primary. Get moving. Get out on the streets. Take action. And then, as a result of taking action, people will start needing the ideas, the confident ideas, and optimism corresponding to the way they feel when they're getting strong. I've never thought that people need to be, you know, given good, sort of handed out good ideas. Powerful communities, empowered communities, people who are taken to the streets and finding strength in one another's solidarity, they will discover the ideas which they need. They will come up with brilliant ideas of their own, completely new ideas. But I do think that in the course of doing that, they will want to reinvestigate the history of the 20th century, the history of philosophy in the 20th century, particularly after the Second World War. We want to be clear about what we've run through and why it is that the left has been so feeble, so weak, so lacking in any kind of coherent vision as to how to get to the future.
Well, this is great, but it looks like to me that getting Chomsky or any of the major parts of the established left to really engage your book has turned out to be even more difficult than you thought, and you thought it was going to be really difficult. So I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, that's true, Doug, but I mean, the only hope we've got is that Chomsky's closest friends and allies sort of nudge him a bit and say, no, I think you really ought to engage a bit with that Chris Knight guy over there.